People Everywhere Still Alive by Krungbin. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Princeton has become the latest university to be targeted by the Trump administration. The federal government's pausing dozens of federal grants to Princeton. The news came a day after the Trump administration threatened to cut off nearly $9 billion to Harvard over the school's response to student-led campus protests in solidarity with Gaza. Earlier, the Trump administration had suspended $175 million in federal funding to the University of Pennsylvania and $400 million to Columbia University. At Columbia, the Board of Trustees responded by agreeing to a series of demands from President Trump in an effort to keep the federal funding. This all comes as Columbia is in a state of turmoil. On Friday, Columbia's interim president, Katrina Armstrong, resigned as president. Columbia's Board of Trustees then elevated its own board co-chair, Claire Shipman, the journalist, to become the school's new interim president. Meanwhile, Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian Columbia student protest leader, remains locked up in an immigration jail in Louisiana more than 3 weeks after he was abducted by ICE agents at his Columbia University housing, after appealing to the president of Columbia to help him. On Tuesday, a federal judge in New Jersey ruled Khalil's lawsuit should move forward to New Jersey, where Khalil was taken before being sent to Louisiana. We're joined now by Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School. Welcome back to Democracy Now! So how unusual is it? I mean, this is now the third woman, the first three women to be president of Columbia University. First, it was Manu Shafiq, and now Katrina Armstrong being fired and replaced by the board co-chair, the Board of Trustees co-chair?
Well, what we're seeing is a continuation and an escalation of the Board of Trustees of Columbia University basically going rogue. There was also a report issued yesterday by the Columbia University Senate, almost 400-page report documenting the ways in which the trustees abused their power over the last 2 years in mismanaging events at Columbia. So Claire Shipman being appointed outside of the normal process, president at Columbia, is part of that pattern of really a takeover of the university by the trustees, by these corporate officers of the university who quite clearly have demonstrated that they do not feel any fidelity to protecting our academic mission, but in a way are working hand in glove with the Trump administration to destroy that very mission.
And Catherine, would you say the board is going rogue? What would be the normal process for the selection of a president at Columbia?
Well, Juan, I'm glad you asked. I brought Columbia's charters and statutes with me, and one section within there very clearly says that where a president or an acting president has stepped down, resigned, or otherwise stepped down from office, the provost is supposed to become the acting president until such time as the trustees conduct a regular search that would involve many stakeholders in the university community. But instead of allowing Angela Olinto, who is the provost of Columbia, who I think is widely well regarded and I think would have been welcomed as an acting president by everyone in our community, instead of that, following the rules of the statutes, they appointed their own co-chair of the Board of Trustees. And Juan, I have to say, it feels like Columbia University has become the Tesla of the U.S. academic community, where wealthy people buy their way onto the Board of Trustees and then appoint themselves CEO of the organization, only to ruin the brand of that institution. No one in their right mind wants a Tesla right now. And people are heading for the doors at Columbia. The admissions just went out for the undergraduate program, and the numbers are way down. Students don't want to come to Columbia. So it feels very similar that we had this kind of hostile takeover of our institution, the one that you've had a long legacy with, Juan, that mirrors what's happening in other parts of the country as well.
And I wanted to ask you about this, the Trump administration's threat to cut off $400 million in federal funding to the university that forced it to back down on some key issues. Columbia has a by my last reading, a $14.8 billion endowment. It could easily have replaced that $400 million for the four years of the Trump administration from its own endowment, which I suspect that's what endowment is for emergency situations. What is your sense of how these universities over the last decades, by depending largely on either corporate donors or federal grants, have put themselves in a bind where they're basically under control by outside forces?
Well, I think that's exactly right, that the business model of a university, particularly large research universities like Columbia, is one that has come over the last many years to depend so heavily on federal money for its budget. It's the largest part of our budget, that along with the fees and other income we get from running the medical school. It's not tuition. It's not major donors. It's those two, the federal money and the medical school income. And when we are in alignment with the U.S. government, that's a great thing. But when we're not, we're incredibly vulnerable. And so I think this is a moment where all universities and higher education more generally needs to have a kind of reckoning of a new kind of business model of how to run a university that isn't so incredibly dependent upon shifts in the political winds in our country. Now, I don't actually think that the endowment is going to save our problem. Much of those funds in Columbia's endowment, which is the smallest endowment of all of the Ivy League schools, I'll note, are tied up in ways where they have to be allocated to particular funding streams. They can't just be reappropriated to fund or replace those federal grants. And it, in any event, would be a short-term Band-Aid. There's too much of the budget to cover with these federal grants that have been pulled. It's $400 million-plus dollars now, but it'll be a lot more. You look at Harvard, they're talking about billions of dollars. The endowment can't possibly fill that gap. So it's time for us to think about things like, why are faculty, or more importantly, university presidents, paid so much? We need to think about who gets paid and valued within the university. It is those very researchers in the medical school who make many times more in salary from a philosophy professor or an English professor at Columbia, in part as a reward for the fact that they've been drawing these federal funds to underwrite the university's business model. So it's time for us to step back and not say, oh, the piggy bank is going to save us, but actually think more critically about how we run our universities.
I wanted to turn to Jeff Sovern. He's one of the four children of Columbia University's first Jewish president, Michael Sovern. On Tuesday, Democracy Now! Reached Jeff and asked him to read out loud the open letter he and his siblings just published in The Washington Post.
Our father, Michael I. Sovern, was the first Jewish president of Columbia University, which he served for more than 60 years. We believe that if he were alive today, he would be disgusted by the government's coercion of Columbia, purportedly in the name of our religion. We don't believe that President Donald Trump is sincere about protecting Jews from anti-Semitism. We find it more likely that an administration whose vice president has agreed with Richard M. Nixon that professors are the enemy is using anti-Semitism as a pretext to damage Columbia and America's other elite universities. Our father is one of only three people interred on his beloved Columbia campus. Trump's attack on the university desecrates a place our family holds sacred. It is both plausible and disturbing that some at Columbia are anti-Semitic. But we do not believe attempts to force the university to relinquish its independence are an appropriate response. And we wish the Trump administration would stop gaslighting us all.
Again, that is Jeff Sovern, one of the four children of Columbia University's first Jewish president, Michael Sovereign. He was reading from an open letter he and his siblings had published in the Washington Post. Professor Catherine Franke, you taught at Columbia for close to a quarter of a century. You ultimately were forced to retire around your support for pro-Palestinian students, Jewish students, Muslim students, students who consider themselves atheists, whatever, but who all share their concern about Israel's assault on Gaza. Can you talk about what he's saying and this hammer of accusations of anti-Semitism, equating them with anti-Zionism?
Well, Michael Sovereign was an incredible president of our university, and his office, after he stepped down from being president, was down the hall from me, so I saw him daily. He led the university through very difficult times and actually was president when I was an undergraduate at Columbia, at Barnard. Columbia didn't admit women at the point that I was an undergrad. And so his children's statement resonates so strongly with those of us who knew President Sovereign very well. I know that Lee Bollinger, our most recent, well, not most recent president, because we've had so many, but our most recent long-term president, is also finally expressing real concerns about the leadership at the university, and I've spoken to a number of the former provosts who feel that Columbia has lost its way in the name of protecting Jewish students, some Jewish students, from bias. And of course, we shouldn't have any form of anti-Semitism on our campus, but this is being used as a fig leaf for a political project. If Columbia really cared about eradicating all forms of bias from our university, then Columbia would have done something seriously about one of my male colleagues at the law school who uses the N-word in class regularly, a white male colleague who thinks that's funny and makes him cool, or another who tells slavery jokes to black students in the classroom. And thinks that's a very funny and appropriate thing to do in the classroom. And the black students in those classes brought complaints to the administration, and nothing happened. So we have an overreaction in the case of anti-Semitism. And again, I don't want to say that there aren't any incidents. There always are forms of anti-Semitism in all the institutions we're part of. But we have actually no reaction to issues of sexism, racism, homophobia, et cetera. In fact, they've taken all that language down off the university's website at this point. I have trans colleagues at Columbia who are afraid for their own safety in the law school building. So the environment is not one that has made any of us feel safer. It is one in which our safety has been weaponized in the name of advancing this larger political project, which is ultimately, I think, about dismantling the very university itself.
And Catherine, I wanted to ask you about the Trump administration's campaign of terror, really, against international students, revoking immigration statuses. The Times of India reports that the State Department has emailed hundreds of international students asking them to self-deport for allegedly participating in campus activism. The United States has long been a place where students from all around the world come to study here. What's the impact of this on not just Columbia, but all universities across the country?
Well, Juan, I can't overstate how terrified our students are. And it's not just the students who are on visas or even green cards. It's all of our students who come from other countries who may even be citizens at this point, because it seems there's no limit to the ways in which this administration is going to both test and violate the law in cleansing. It feels like a kind of racial and ethnic cleansing that is happening on our campuses. One of the reasons I loved being a Columbia professor was that in many of my classes, half of the students came from other countries. They brought their experiences, their wisdom, other notions of other legal systems, other cultures into the classroom, and it made it such a rich learning environment. I learned so much from them. And when I talk to my colleagues now, I'm not teaching anymore, but I'm hearing that those students are not saying a word. And some of them are not even coming onto campus anymore because they're afraid of getting nabbed and of having the administration actually turn over their cell phones and home addresses. So the classes are actually being emptied of those voices and of those bodies, and it's a loss for the Columbia community, but it's a horrible form of terror for the actual students who are so frightened.
As we talk about what's happening to students, I wanted to end. We only have about a minute. On Tuesday, a federal judge in New Jersey ruled that Mahmoud Khalil, he was the negotiator between the students and Columbia University. He was a grad student at SEPA who had a green card, that his case, he was taken from Columbia University housing. His green card was revoked, taken away from his wife, who is about to give birth, and sent to a Louisiana ICE jail. The judge in New Jersey ruled his case should move forward in New Jersey, where he was taken before being sent to Louisiana. What's happening in this case? You were an advisor to Mahmoud Khalil.
I worked very closely with him for, you know, a year and a half, as did the university. They picked him as the student that they wanted to sit in the middle between the students that were protesting and the administration itself, because they knew he was mature, he was reasonable, everyone trusted him. He was the exactly right person to be the negotiator between the university and the students. And then they put a target on his back, essentially, by allowing untruths to circulate in social media and elsewhere, to come out of the mouth of the Secretary of State and other Trump administration officials. You know, it just breaks my heart, Amy, to see what's happening to him and his family, but not only them. He is still in that detention center, that horrible place in Louisiana, even though the case is in New Jersey. And his lawyers are fighting very hard, I know all of them well, to get him moved. His case has been moved, but he has not been moved. And they're still making arguments to the judge to bring Mahmoud home so that he'll be home-ish in New Jersey, so that he'll be closer to his family and to his lawyers. It is a horrendous object lesson of how the institutions that you think you're part of and can trust turn on you, whether it's Columbia or the United States government, and how hard it is to then bring him back to a place of security and freedom. And we're all just hoping that these next arguments in court will bring Mahmoud back at least to a detention center in New Jersey, which is better than where he is now.
Catherine Franke, former professor at Columbia Law School. She was there for a quarter of a century, forced to retire in January. Coming up, Trump's immigration crackdown coming under increased criticism as the administration admits it flew a Salvadorian father, a Maryland father, with protected status to a prison in El Salvador. Back in 20 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We look now at how the Trump administration's transferred another group of immigrants to a supermax mega prison complex in El Salvador. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Monday 17 immigrants from Venezuela and El Salvador accused of being gang members have been sent to the Salvadoran mega prison Sunday after previously being detained at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Since Trump took office, the U.S. has expelled hundreds of immigrants and asylum seekers to El Salvador without due process, accusing many of belonging to gangs largely on the basis of having tattoos. One Venezuelan asylum seeker now held in the Salvadoran prison was removed for tattoos on each forearm that read "Mom" and "Dad." This week, the U.S. admitted in a court filing that a Salvadoran dad with protected status was also among the hundreds of immigrants who were transferred to El Salvador. He was living with his family in Maryland. Kilmar Armando Abrego had been granted protected status in 2019, blocking the federal government from sending him back to El Salvador after he fled gang violence there. The Trump administration said Garcia was removed, quote, because of an administrative error, and that though it could not bring him back because it's now in custody of El Salvador. Conservatives like MAGA podcaster Joe Rogan are also joining and speaking out against the removal of a professional makeup artist accused of being a gang member, calling the case horrific.
You got to get scared that people who are not criminals are getting, like, lassoed up and deported and sent to, like, El Salvador prisons. Mm-hmm. This is kind of crazy that that could be possible. That's horrific. And that's, again, that's bad for the cause. Like, the cause is let's get the gang members out. Everybody agrees. But let's not innocent gay hairdressers get lumped up with the gangs. And then, like, how long before that guy can get out? Like, can we figure out how to get him out?
This comes as U.S. District Judge Edward Chen in San Francisco has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's efforts to end deportation relief and work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants with temporary protected status. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Aaron Reichlin Melnick, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. Aaron, thanks so much for being with us again. Can you explain what is happening right now? Talk about the Maryland dad from El Salvador who was just deported to this human rights abuse using mega prison. The administration is paying Bukele, the president of El Salvador, millions to hold these immigrants and asylum seekers.
Yeah, so on March 15th, the Trump administration sent three planes full of people to El Salvador with people they claimed were members of MS-13 or the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. The problem is every single day now, new stories are coming out showing they made a lot of mistakes. And over the weekend, we found out for the first time that that they made a mistake that they are admitting. And that was the deportation of a Maryland dad, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who was sent there despite the fact that an immigration judge in 2019 ruled that he had protection from being deported to El Salvador. It was illegal to send him to El Salvador. And so now the Trump administration has had to admit they made a mistake there. But more and more evidence suggests this was a rushed operation where they shoved as many people onto those planes as they could that had been entered in a database somewhere as Tren de Aragua, and they never really bothered to check whether or not that was true. They just looked at people's tattoos and said, well, you know, we have an intelligence report that says people from Tren de Aragua have tattoos with crowns on them. So any person who has a crown on their body that's tattooed is a Tren de Aragua member. We don't need to go any further than that. And that's basically the level of due process people got. They weren't even told that they were being sent there, though. New stories coming out today confirms every person who was sent there was lied to and told that they were going to be deported to Venezuela. And they didn't find out till they landed in El Salvador what had actually happened.
Well, Aaron, even after the admission of the administration in terms of Abrego Garcia's case, Vice President J.D. Vance posted on the social media platform X that he was a convicted MS-13 gang member with no legal right to be here. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's just simply false. Now, I'll take each one of those in turn. Convicted. He's not been convicted of anything. Mr. Abrego Garcia arrived here in 2011 as a 16-year-old fleeing the gangs himself, who had threatened to kill him if he didn't join them. He, like many thousands of youth that left El Salvador in that period, came to the United States seeking safety. And for the last 14 years has not gotten into any serious trouble with the law at all. He's been convicted of nothing. But what happened is in 2019, he was looking for day labor outside of a Home Depot in Maryland, and local cops arrested him and three other men there. Those local cops interrogated him, demanded to know whether he was connected to a gang. He denied it continuously. And then a local police detective wrote on a gang worksheet that a confidential informant had allegedly claimed that this guy was a member of a gang, a part of MS-13 that operated in Long Island. Mr. Abrego Garcia has never lived in Long Island, and he said this is ridiculous. And when his lawyers in 2019 tried to reach back out to the police to talk to the detective and say, hey, why did you put this down here? They found out that the detective had been suspended and the local police didn't even have a record of his arrest. So that is the only evidence that the government has ever offered that he is connected to MS-13. And despite that arrest, which did not lead to charges, he has never been charged or convicted of a crime once in his life. He also did win protection. In 2019, that arrest led to him being sent to ICE detention. He was locked in ICE detention for almost a year, and at the end, a judge granted him a protection known as withholding of removal that said, you are more likely than not to be persecuted if sent to El Salvador. So the one thing the government cannot do is deport you to El Salvador. And that's exactly what happened on March 15th.
But you recently testified in front of the Committee on Homeland Security, the Subcommittee on Border Security Enforcement, that Trump's diversion of thousands of law enforcement officers to mass deportation is actually creating a greater national security risk. Could you explain that?
Yeah, so the most important thing that people need to know about what the Trump administration is doing, well, one of the most important things is that they have turned the entire U.S. federal law enforcement apparatus into an immigration enforcement apparatus. President Trump has diverted thousands of federal law enforcement officers away from their normal duties and told them to go carry out immigration arrests instead. One in four DEA agents that normally are out there tracking down drug rings are now involved in immigration enforcement instead. 80% of ATF investigators are now doing immigration enforcement. They've taken people from the IRS who are specialized in investigating financial crimes, and they're doing immigration enforcement. And even troublingly, they're taking the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force and making them do immigration enforcement, and Homeland Security Investigations, where investigators have the job of protecting children from sexual predators online, those people have been taken off of their duties of going after pedophiles and have been told that they have to do immigration enforcement instead. None of that is making the country safer. It's just transforming the entire country into a dragnet for immigrants while letting a lot of other people doing some pretty bad things off the hook.
Let me ask you about U.S. District Judge Edward Chen in San Francisco temporarily blocking the Trump administration's efforts to end deportation relief and work permits for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants and TPS. With TPS, a third of a million have TPS. They could face mass deportation. In his ruling, the judge said that Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem's move to terminate TPS for Venezuelans will, quote, inflict irreparable harm on hundreds of thousands of persons whose lives, families, livelihoods will be severely disrupted, cost the U.S. billions in economic activity, and injure public health and safety in communities throughout the United States. The significance of this in this minute we have left, Aaron.
It's enormous. There was potentially 350,000 people were going to lose their job on April 7th. And another 300,000 in September, and then potentially 500,000 Haitians coming up this fall as well. And what Judge Chen ruled is if you want to terminate TPS, you've got to go through the right procedures, and you can't do it based on false claims that hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans are all Tren de Aragua criminals when the status is only available to people with no criminal record.
What do you think in terms of the numbers that the Trump administration is claiming, more than 100,000 people deported so far in his administration?
Yeah, those numbers seem likely incorrect. They don't fit. The Trump administration said yesterday they'd also done 110,000 arrests already. That suggests they did 70,000 arrests in the last 2 weeks. I think somebody in the administration made a mistake. But what we know is these are the numbers they want. Their goal is to ramp up deportations and arrests as quickly as they can. And if that leads to a bunch of innocent people getting swept up alongside, the message that the White House is sending is they don't care. As long as they hit their numbers, who cares who's on those planes? They just want to get them out of the country.
Federal judges ordered the Trump administration to restore funds to programs that provide legal services to unaccompanied minors, to children in immigration proceedings. 10 seconds.
Great news. Children need lawyers. No child should have to face deportation in court alone. And the Trump administration wanted to strip away federally funded lawyers that Congress set aside money for.
We're going to leave it there. Aaron Reichland Melnick, senior fellow at the American Immigration Council. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Bernie.